So we teach and we've been educated within the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And that tradition teaches nine vehicles, nine perspectives on reality. And there are many diverse teachings in the nine vehicles, and at the same time, the Dzogchen, or great perfection, or the great completeness, undergirds and backlights all of the other traditions. And so what I want to say tonight is both informed by some of the earliest teachings and the earlier vehicles, and as well as a perspective that would be consonant with the highest teachings as well. And some of it's very simple to hear, but it might provide you with days, weeks, months, and years of contemplation. We're talking about the relationship of wisdom and compassion. And it's a big and complicated topic. We could say we were talking about all of Buddhism and all of Buddha's teachings and Buddha's practice. And it turns out that Buddha's teachings are holographic, and we can enter them in any numbers of ways. And what's particularly interesting when you study with Tibetan teachers, they will often say, and this particular way of practice is most supreme. And a week later, they might give you a very, very different teaching, and you'll hear that that particular teaching is most excellent. We did have a Gelugpa teacher named Geshe Rupten. He was a great, great teacher. And he once gave a talk at the Tibetan Library of Works and Archives. I think that's where it was. That's my memory, anyway. That Buddhist teachings were like a pie. And wherever you bit into it, it was delicious. So, from that perspective, this week's is excellent, and next week's is excellent. So sometimes when we teach about compassion and wisdom, we talk a lot about compassion as almost a prelude, a predecessor, a support for wisdom. But we can just as well talk about wisdom as an entree to compassion. And there are many reasons why that is the case. Maybe in shorthand way, we can say that, one, if we're bumbling about through life with a really, really strong sense of an inherently existent self, kind of self-contained, autonomous, separate, kind of walled off and impenetrable, it may be something of a challenge to feel particularly related to an other who is similarly constituted as a kind of reified, real other. My feelings of compassion have to go from this real, reified, autonomous, independently existent self to you as an autonomous, independently, impermeable, substantial existent self. It's a lot of work we've got to do to make that kind of compassion occur. And anything that we understand about the non-inherent existence, the non-substantial existence of the self, allows compassion to flow more freely, more fluidly. That's kind of one avenue of understanding how wisdom leads to compassion and love, or can support it. Another is more informed in a way by a kind of Dzogchen view, would be that in our prayer we say, essence, nature, moving love, mandal. Essence is emptiness, the nature is luminosity or clarity, and moving love, mandal, is the expression of emptiness and clarity. And Khetsen Sangpo certainly always used to say that if one realizes the true nature of one's mind, just spontaneously the nature of the mind is compassion, and it's an extraordinary compassion, and it's a very different order and kind of compassion that can shine forth when one has actually arrived at some sense of the nature of one's mind, which is the deepest wisdom that is talked about in the Dzogchen tradition. And we'll say something about how sensing touches us into a deeper experience of what we are. I would like to make a few remarks about how the meditation I led is a gateway to a deeper understanding of what we are. We'll probably be doing more of this in the come the summer and fall. There is a school of Buddhism, or tenet school, called practitioners of yoga. They're also called mind only, but really they should be called cognizance only would be better. And they teach about three aspects of reality. One is a deluded aspect, and that has to do with the sense of self and other. And one has to do with the dependently originated aspect of reality, which is our experience of consciousness or cognizance. It's really cognizance only. And the third has to do with emptiness, and that has to do with nothing is inherently or substantially existent. Now, the relationship between all of those three is very, very important and very interesting, and we're not going to go into that now. But I'll say the following and just sort of throw them out as sucking candies that we can all suck on for a few years and maybe decades if we're lucky. So if I were to ask you where your eye perception resides, or what is your eye perception or your seeing, if I were to ask you where do you feel that seeing occurs, what might you say? There are no wrong answers, just what's your, based on your experience, where is seeing occurring? Yes, Terry.
In my eyes,
in your eyes,
my brain.
And in your brain. Okay.
You left out the second time a very important phrase, I believe. When you first said it, you said, my eyes and I assume my brain. And
right,
I think that's very important because you were, I think, making a distinction between your actual experience and what your idea about things is.
Right.
And that's actually a very significant divide to recognize. So I just didn't want that to go away.
So one of the things we can say about Buddhist practice is that it is saturated with agnosticism. And that is to say, not knowing. And part of what practice is really about is taking what we think we know and exploring it really quite rigorously. So the sun that we see, where is the sun that we see? We see, look at the sun. Where is that? When we see the sun, where is that? This is a real question.
In the microphone, please. Say it. Go ahead. Go ahead. You're on a roll. You'll wait. Other people will wake up.
In the sky.
In the sky. Okay.
In front of me.
In the sky in front of you. And do you think that the sun that you're seeing right at 7:38 daylight savings time in a couple of weeks or whatever it will be, that sun still exists? The sunlight still exists that you're seeing in the sun?
I'm not sure I understand.
Do you think that the sunlight mm-hmm. that you're seeing right now,
mm-hmm.
if it were light out,
yeah.
is actually on the sun?
I think it's coming from the sun.
Yeah, it's come from
yes.
the sun. It's traveled a long time.
Yes. But yeah.
Do you think it's still there?
Do you feel it's still there?
Yes.
Maybe, yeah, okay.
Yes.
So one of the blessed things that science confounds us with is that, sorry, the sunlight we're seeing is 8 minutes old. For all we know, the sun could have been obliterated. Hmm?
8 minutes ago.
8 minutes ago. But we're still seeing it. It's kind of disconcerting. Claire, you have something to say? And just to throw out another question, we all in our culture, of course, think that we're seeing things in our brain. So there's perception that we understand is occurring in our brain. Now, the brain is sort of an objective description that our neuroscientists tell us about. But our experience is something yet again different. Now, there is a big conversation amongst neuroscientists about the difference and the similarity between our experience and what scientists see. But when we're seeing the sun, if we're daring to look at it, let's see. There is some powerful way. Well, let me put it this way. Do most people feel when they're seeing the sun that there's an eye that's seeing the sun? Welcome to normality. I mean, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with I see the sun. So it becomes an interesting exploration, this I thing. Buddhism makes an interesting claim, and that is that this I that we all feel is so real and is so usual is not quite what we assume it to be. We all assume we have this I, just the capital I. And a lot of effort in Buddhism goes into exploring our experience to see if we can find it. Now, to jump to the end of the story, in a way, to go all the way to Dzogchen, in a way, if you search for the I and you come up wanting, there may be a kind of an experience of emptiness or space or unfindability. And again, we'll be talking about Buddha nature and Dzogchen a lot. And when we teach the Dzogchen cycles, there is some sense that that kind of emptiness is not sterile, but it's actually out of that that experience arises. But one of the ways of arriving at that kind of understanding of emptiness is to look very, very carefully at our experience. And part of that can really start quite profitably with some very, very honestly brokered questions of, when I'm seeing, is there like an I in my seeing? When I'm hearing, is there an actual I that's hearing? When I'm thinking, even, is there an I that's thinking, or is there just cognizing or thinking? When I'm sensing in my body, is it merely a consciousness of sensing as opposed to an I that is sensing? We all kind of believe there's a Wizard of Oz somewhere behind a curtain somewhere, and basically the Buddhist enterprise is find the wizard. Pretty much you could sum it up that way. Find the wizard. Honestly explored, do you get your hands on the wizard? So we've been teaching this kind of meditation of, it's really based on the mindfulness discourse of that Gautama gave. You find it in the Theravada scriptures, of observing, seeing, hearing, sensing, talking or thinking, or emoting, mental consciousness. Technically, there's also smelling and tasting. But if you want to get the short course on Buddhist cognitive psychology, there are essentially six forms of knowing: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, and minding, thinking. And if we look at all of them rigorously, tear apart this conglomeration, aside from that, there's no wizard. The punchline being, if you were to take a firebrand and you move it very, very slowly, you feel like the firebrand is a moment of light. You move it very, very quickly, the firebrand looks like a circle. You take all of these consciousnesses and get very, very sharp in perceiving what they really are as opposed to what we think they are, and you see pixelated experiences of consciousness, individual moments of consciousness. If it runs very, very slow, if your mind, if your perceiving apparatus is slow, it feels like a whole conglomerated whole. So there is a Buddhist discourse that we can give out.
We will give it.
And those of you who are observing at a distance have
Jerry
this,
has sent it to you.
Has sent it to you.
You have it. You have your...
And so the translation of this is by a British Theravada monk. I think he's British. His name is Ajahn Sumedho. And he comes out of the forest tradition of Thai Buddhism. It's a very short discourse. And I think there are a lot of wonderful pieces to this particular discourse. One is it shows how in the early tradition, how dialogical the teachings were. And that is, the discourses were called discourses because they were conversations. Buddha would actually talk with people. The other is, a lot of them have a kind of tongue-in-cheek kind of sense of humor about them. And I think it's important to appreciate that the Gotama that is portrayed is a bit funny. It's a bit funny. It's also that they're a bit pithy and they can benefit from some commentary which I'll offer. And they can really, really, this exchange, you know, in Nyingma Dzogchen, there's a lot. We talk often about quintessential instructions, which are quite brief and to the point and can really be contemplated over and over and over to great fruitional benefit. And this particular discourse is really a quintessential instruction. There's a lot in it for a lot of contemplation. So I will read it to you. So another teaching from the same collection, and this is from what's called the Udana, and the Udana are kind of, it's an interesting collection of the discourses in Theravada. It's a little bit different from most of the other discourses are quite organized, and the way they even organize the discourses are, there is the longer discourses and the middle-length discourses. And it's all very, very organized, and even the discourses themselves are organized. The Udana are more like songs or kind of, sometimes they're songs or poems or they're kind of like stray teachings. It's a kind of an assortment of very, very interesting, and some of the most interesting and uncategorizable teachings of the Buddha are found in the Udana. So this appears there. It's the eighth, it's the first discourse of the eighth segment of the Udana. And so it says, another teaching from the same collection recounts the story of a wanderer named Bahiya. So it's a technical term, actually. At the time of the Buddha, there were wanderers. We would probably call these people hippies. And these are just, and they're still existent in India today. These are people, some of them don't wear any clothing. Some of them wear the clothing the criminals would wear. The actually saffron robes was the color that prison mates wore in the time of the Buddha. And so they adopted that as the uniform. Sometimes these wanderers will wear what we would in English politely call jock straps. That's all they're wearing. But some of them, like Jains, are just totally naked. And they wander. They have a begging bowl of some sort, and they wander from place to place, and they ask people for some food. And they have conversations, and they take up strange practices. You know, maybe I'll sit by the shore of the Ganges and stand on my head and have a fire to the north of me and the east of me and the west of me and the south of me. And people still do this and see what that does for me. Maybe I'll get liberated. And if you read the Buddha scriptures, a lot of that is actually described because Buddha tried most of those things and he didn't actually get liberated. But that was those were the hippies. They were called Tramanera, or Pali, they're Samana. These are wanderers, and this was kind of, these were the folks who, you know, you'd have a lot of discourses with. They'd come up and, you know, tell me what you got, I'll tell you what I've got. So he stopped the Buddha on the street in Savatthi, also called Shravasti, and said, "Venerable sir, you are the Samana Gotama." So he's just saying, you're the wanderer Gotama. "Your Dharma is famous throughout the land. Please teach me that I may understand the truth." The Buddha replied, "We're on our alms round, Bahia. This is not the right time." So Bahia responds, "Life is uncertain, venerable sir. We never know when we are going to die. Please teach me the Dharma." And so even to this very, very day, sometimes people come to us and are very, very insistent and say, "Oh, life is short, and tell me the punchline." The dialogue repeats itself three times. Three times over, the Buddha says the same thing, and Bahia responds in the same way. And finally, the Buddha says, "When a Tathagata," and that literally means one who has understood things as they are, "is pressed three times, he has to answer. Listen carefully, Bahia, and attend to what I say. In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, there is only the sensed. In the cognized, there is only the cognized. Thus should you see that. Indeed, there is no thing there. This, Bahia, is how you should train yourself. Since, Bahia, there is for you in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized, as you see that there is no thing here, you will therefore see that indeed there is no thing there. As you see there is no thing there, you will see that you are therefore located neither in the world of this nor in the world of that, nor in any place between the two. This alone is the end of suffering." Upon hearing these words, Bahia was immediately enlightened. Moments later, he was killed by a runaway cow. So he was right. Life is uncertain. Later, Bahia was awarded the title, "The disciple who understood the teaching most quickly." So, of course, there's a little bit of a shorthand here, and at least the commentary that Ajahn Sumedho gives, and it's kind of evident. When it's saying there is no there and there is no here, it's saying something very profound that is really something to contemplate. And I'm going to offer it to you. It's saying that while, of course, everybody's experience is that you're seeing a wall and there's an eye or a subject seeing the wall, what is being said here is actually the only thing that is occurring is that seeing is occurring. And if you're actually in the experience of seeing, you will not split out an object and a subject. And so when we do our homage to Mother Wisdom, these are hard words to translate. It says, "Wisdom unsaid, unthought, unexpressed." It's really referring to the fact that in our actual experience, and this is kind of the real serious punchline, which is so hard for us because we're all steeped in books and thought and knowledge and chattiness. If we actually get into the heart of our actual experience, we will see that, yeah, there's just seeing, but that division into subject and object is not intrinsic to seeing. There's hearing, but that subject-object split is not intrinsic to hearing. Sensing, likewise. And even in thinking, there's just the process of thinking without some wizard thinking the thought. It's just thinking is occurring. So there's no there, and there's no here. And so the here is the subject, and the there is the object. And the part of the puzzle is, can we allow ourselves to get out of what we've all been inculcated into in terms of what our experience is, which is, I'll give you for an instance. We were in pilgrimage with Ketsen Sangbo in 1999, and I'd been hanging around in this universe for a while. And you can try this. You know, if you're in a car, not while you're driving, please, but if you're a passenger, you will notice that your normal, or even walking, your normal perspective is there is this kind of fixed subject and you are moving through this landscape, which is also kind of fixed. And it's really quite subject and object. There's something else you can do. You can just kind of, in a way, let go of that and say, okay, let me just experience what is actually occurring to my eye consciousness as I walk or as I'm sitting in a passenger seat in a car. What is my eye consciousness as opposed to my sense of I and a visible object? And the eye consciousness, in its purity, is kind of this experience of things moving through, it's just this kind of a movie, and it's changing. And where is the subject? And where is the object? Now, you can very easily get that felt sense of subject and object, but you might also play around with, well, what if I kind of just let go of that? And just see what experience is. Now, if you can make headway with that, it's part of a process that would ultimately lead to some appreciation and experience of a kind of spaciousness that undergirds, permeates ultimately experience. And that's what's being talked about in the Heart Sutra. Excuse me while I destroy that. It says form is emptiness. It's really talking about the perception of form. It's empty. There's no actual independently existing form. The emptiness and the form are simultaneously and interpenetrated. And certainly the most significant in a way, and I think, you know, I've done a lot of thinking and practicing. I think for us as Westerners, one of the easiest ways to arrive at some sense of this is to work with, to begin with, looking at our experience of these consciousnesses. What are those? What are our actual experiences of consciousness? And if we're really staying with those, do we find a sense of self in any of these particular senses of consciousness? And just to tie it back into the theme, not in a black and white way, but if there's some progress in having a felt sense of self thinning out and a felt sense of other thinning out, how does that affect our ability to feel for others and even have compassion for ourselves? I will leave it with that.
Okay. So in the seen, there is only the seen. It sounds nice, doesn't it? I mean, even if you let your mind be okay with not quite understanding what he's talking about, it sounds so. In the seeing, in the seen, there's only the seen. In the heard, there's only the heard. It sounds so simple and flowing and encompassing. And, you know, it's different if you say, to say in the seen, there is only the seen. In the seen, there is only the seen. I saw the moon. It's a little different, no? Even just to say it, am I the only one who thinks that? I see the moon. I see you. When I say I see you, we right away have the two-ness, the dualism, the here and the there that we that Harvey is talking about, that the sutra is talking about. What can he possibly mean? Buddha is saying there's no... Indeed, there is no thing there. As you see that there is no thing here, you will see... And you see that there is no thing here. You will therefore see, indeed, that there is no thing there. Here and there are mutually informing, right? Once there's no here, there's no there. You can't have one without the other. Likewise, self and other, me and you, those categories, as we have talked about, those of you who have been around when we talked about Shantideva, and this is a theme that keeps coming back and back and back. When we, in our ordinary way of conceiving of how perception works, I see you, I'm here, and you're there, here and there. If I say I like you, then the here and there start to melt a little bit, right? The distance between here and there, between you and me when I like you, is a little bit warmed up. It's not quite a chasm of distance. And so what we can see from that, and what we hope to be seeing over time more and more clearly, is that the sense of here and there, I and you, subject and object, is relevant when we, whether we are considering compassion or wisdom, both of them are suggesting that here and there, I and you, self and other, subject and object, are not two poles separated by some blank chasm over which your mind has to throw itself in order to grab onto an object that is there while you are here. That's kind of the biggest problem with the universe, isn't it? What you want is there, or more there than you would like, because you want it here. On the other hand, you might be here and not like what's here, but you can't get there. So, I mean, pretty much everything we think about, whether it's in terms of physical distance or in terms of time, you know, we all want enlightenment. The problem is it's in the future. So we think. It's there. But when we start to question who the denizen of here and now is, the I, the me, the self, and we start to come up empty, then it's like the world cracks open. When you no longer have the, as Harvey talked about, this sort of concrete sense of me, which is not easy, of course, to soften up, but we can still begin to appreciate, then when we don't have this, I'm the most important, I'm the center of the universe, who of us doesn't think that? Most of the time, right? And then we keep bumping into other people who think the same thing. and the problems of the world unfold from that. So it's really a big thing that we're talking. We're talking about the fulcrum of emotional distance, the fulcrum of feeling, you know, that there are the problem of the other, you know, the other who is less than, or maybe too great and frightening for that reason. But anyway, who isn't me and with whom I will never have the kind of intimate, safe, you know, connection, undisputed connection that I now have with whatever I call me. So when we cultivate As we do always when we begin practice, we say, may all beings throughout space, may they have happiness and the causes of happiness. And if we're not totally spacing out when we say that, which also happens in my experience, but if we're, there's some kind of connection happening. The distance between self and other, the distance between here and there is softened. And that tends to feel good. It's why we love being around people that we love. We begin to divest ourselves of our armor, our protection, our habitual ways of reacting that are so automatic they don't even express anything that's really deep within us. And we feel lonely from our own nature, our own potential. You know, we all know, I think, what it's like to, you know, be in a situation, maybe it's a social situation, maybe it's a work situation, and there we are, and we're not quite comfortable, and, you know, you have to show up somehow in these contexts. So we kind of put on a personality, something we saw from mom, something we saw from dad, we throw it on like, you know, it's the clothing we have, you can't go out naked, you have to wear some kind of persona. So we put it on, and before we know it, it's really starting to stick to us, and we can't even pull it off if we want to, and yet we know it's not genuine. And not only is it not genuine, it is preventing us from experiencing who and what we really are, which at the very, very bottom of things, the bottom of the well of our being, perhaps we actually want more than anything, just to feel being, feel us, feel who we are and what we are. So the purpose of practicing wisdom is to begin to see through this fake covering that we're always wearing, and we hardly know how to pull it off. But still, if we look, like Harvey was saying, where is this I? Where is this anger? Where is this, you know, whatever our presenting persona is, who is it? Where is it? Hairs in your head. We'll get to that in a minute. And it can be a big challenge to start to recognize that this me that you were clinging to, you can't really put your hand on it. It can be kind of disturbing, honestly. But it also at the same one and the same time is such a relief. Oh, I mean, I don't have to always react in that way for the rest of my life. It might be tough to shift that habit because habits have a way of persisting, but it's not me. It could go away. I could stop doing this thing that I always do. And I would be even more blossoming and me. But not the kind of me that is here and not there. More like some kind of open gesture of welcoming and caring. And so this is one way we can understand that wisdom moves to compassion. Why do we fail to be compassionate? Why? Actually, Geshe Rupten asked us this very question in his mud hut above McLeod Gunj in Dharamsala in, I think, 1972, because he was teaching cultivation of compassion. Well, usually we're not kind or compassionate because we feel that other people don't deserve it. They're not nice to us, principally. They're not nice to us. So we can see and how our whole sense of how we relate to others is very much tied up with a sense that there's a me that they are not nice to, and that there's a them who is not being nice. And so we're all set. You know, the duel is ready to begin because you've got two opponents. Cultivation of compassion necessitates ultimately that we question this sense of I that makes us feel separate enough from others that it seems right not to care for them. So So wisdom inevitably leads to deep compassion. We are told. Let's see if it works. The essence of emptiness is love, is compassion. And this has to do also with the conviction deep, deep, deep in all the Buddhist traditions, and especially strong, as you may know, in the Nyingma trajectory to Dzogchen teachings, that we have something really gets called Buddha nature. It's kind of like open space and endless possibility. And we all have this. And we all actually would love to live in that. But because we are so stuck in the different kinds of persona that we develop over the course of our lives, and we develop them, actually we come out of the womb with some kind of propensity, just ask Renee, you know, no, children aren't, babies even aren't the same. There's already some inclination. But in any case, we develop, and we develop a kind of armor, is one way to talk about it. And sometimes you can, I might actually feel it that way, you know, like, why do I feel like I'm just engulfed by crocodile skin? It doesn't feel very nice. Or something like that. You can have strange experiences, right? Some sense that you are being covered by something. Maybe your own anger, your own fear, your own irritation, your own disappointment. We're all covered by something. And because we are covered by that, that precludes us from, you know, dancing in the infinite space that is our nature, as we will hear again and again, our great friend Long Chemba tells us in many, many different ways, wearing the orange there. So wisdom begins to dissolve this. And actually we seek to dissolve it, partly to be free of it, and partly so that we can experience the natural compassion that naturally effulges, emptiness, nature, heart move, mandala. Once we're empty and our nature is luminous, what is there to do but for light to do but to flow out into the world and illuminate it, whatever is there? And that's kind of the image of what we are seeking to become and to realize.
If you enjoyed this teaching, please visit our website, donmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness and its causes. May all beings always be free of pain and its causes.